It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
And it's been a dull, miserable old day here in Salford. So it has. We've had a bit of rain today. Yes, yes. It is Tuesday's programme, the 28th of April 2020. My name is Richie Allen. Hope you've had a good day. Now, I've got two very interesting guests lined up for you today. Hopefully, the interweb thing will work and we won't have any outages there like we did yesterday. I think we'll be fine, fingers crossed. Welcome to your Richie Allen radio show. I look forward to reading your tweets as well. Keep the old tweets coming in, please. Tweet me or forever hold your peace.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, you have heard Dr. Stuart Wayton on this program before. He writes for several newspapers. He is a criminologist, a lecturer, and he's an author. And I've invited Stuart on to talk about, well, the more sinister aspects of the lockdown. What the lockdown means for civil liberties. He's a great guy, Stuart, and he joins the programme this hour. And I reached out to Tony Heller this morning. Tony was on the Richie Allen Show back in December. He's the man behind realclimatescience.com. He's a geologist, very successful man, has worked in the educational sector, and he's worked in engineering. Very, very good YouTube channel. Tony will be on to talk about some of his tweets about lockdown, and we might start looking into the future with Tony. Will there be calls? Well, I think there already have been calls by Extinction Rebellion type people to keep some aspect of the lockdown in the future. Because one of the great things about the lockdown is it's healing the planet. Because we're not working. We're not creating so much carbon, you see. We might have to hold on to some of those measures in the near future to protect Mother Earth. Yes. I think you know what I think of that, so I won't waste my time telling you. Now, this is interesting. Won't dwell on it too much, but I suppose I better bring it up. There is a charity in the UK called Hope Not Hate. Yes, Hope Not Hate. It's an anti-racism charity. It goes after hate on the internet. It wants to rid the world of hate and haters, presumably. Now, it carried out a series of polls between February and April. They basically contacted random voters in the UK. And it's apparently the largest poll ever of the nation's attitude to conspiracy theories. Yes. And amazingly, my name was used in the survey. Right. Laughable. A journalist. A radio presenter. They said I'm a far-right conspiracy theorist. And they used my name. Now, what they did was, they've written extensively about conspiracy theories. But as part of their article, they, when they were surveying people, they were throwing names at them. Names like David Icke, Alex Jones, Paul Joseph Watson, Alex's fluffer, Tony Robinson. Not Tony Robinson. Not Tony. Not Tony, the Blackadder actor turned excavation guy. Tommy Robinson, Katie Hopkins, Jordan Peterson, and my name. They threw our names at people to see what the response would be. Did people know? And then they linked coronavirus conspiracy theories and 5G conspiracy theories with anti-Semitism. Because ultimately, all roads lead to anti-Semitism, you see. When people are asking questions about 5G and about the lockdown and coronavirus, what they really mean is that the Jews. It's the Jews. Stupid. Apparently. And this is nonsense, of course, but this is one of their findings. And they also find in their report that conspiracy theories cause real world physical harm. So something needs to be done. And here's a little paragraph from their conclusion. Now, you might think it's nothing. You might think, ah, well, Richie, Hope Not Hate. It's a charity. It's a charity. Listen, let me tell you. These people shape UK government policy. They really do. So here's a little paragraph from the end there. While some conspiracy theory material is already demonetized on YouTube, meaning that the creator is not getting any advertising, as the example of Paul Joseph Watson shows, conspiracy theorists can still advertise to sell items outside of YouTube. Only removing the content and conspiracy theorists from the website will stop this effectively, which in turn will lower the incentives to spread conspiracy theory propaganda. That was a poor use of language by the authors of the Hope Not Hate study. What they mean by removing them from the website is removing them from the internet. You see, Hope Not Hate is advocating that people like David Icke and Infowars.com and Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins are basically deleted from the internet. And by doing that, that will kind of de-incentivize other content creators to spread conspiracy theories. It's fairly shocking, isn't it? And just as a matter of interest, not shocking but not surprising, but again, very dangerous because these people shape government policy. For what it's worth, by the way, they, in one section, and I've posted to Facebook, I've posted a link to the PDF of the entire report. There is one chart, one graph, and it looks at the familiarity among the whole population of so-called common far-right activists and conspiracy theorists. Right? They've only done 7. So they say this is the biggest study ever undertaken. And it shows the popularity in the whole population of certain people. Shall we do the chart countdown, shall we? Who's top of the pops of the far-right conspiracy theorists? Right. They've only listed 7. And the BBG is at the bottom at number 7. It's me. This is some pile of bullshit. Apparently 6% of the overall population in the country recognises the name Richie Allen. It could be that striker who scored a very famous goal for Salford, Richie Allen, a couple of years ago. Could be him. At number 6, Paul Joseph Watson, 7%. Yes, 1% ahead of the BBG, Paul Joseph Watson. Beat me by a single percentage. I can't live with that, to be honest. At number 6, Paul Joseph Watson. At number 5, Jordan Peterson with 12%. At number 4, Infowars. 14% of UK people recognise Infowars. Number 3, David Icke, the Diane of UK conspiracy theorists, 51%. Tommy Robinson at number 2 with 53%. And Katie Hopkins is number 1. 68% of those polled allegedly heard of Katie Hopkins. It's a load of bollocks. If you believe that, nearly 4 million people in this country have heard of this radio programme, right?
Do we have enough?
No. Not having it. Not sure about that at all. Let's move on. Mad stuff in the papers today. You might have seen this. Professors from universities around the country have been putting their heads together about how to get us, well, out of our homes, basically, and back doing what we used to do. One of the things they've been talking about is social distancing in pubs, when pubs have reopened, whenever that is. And one of the proposals, this is genuine. Oh, it's genuine. Number of newspapers carrying this today. One of the proposals is, we'll only be allowed to have 3 pints before being asked to leave, you see. 3 pints before being asked to leave. And we will have to be kept apart inside the pub, so only a certain amount of people will be allowed in at the same time. Hence, you can only have 3 pints. So I've got images going through my mind of queues around the back of pubs with people waiting to go in while people inside are having their 3 pints, rationing, shouting across the room to your best mate because you can't sit alongside him. Do you want another one? What? Do you want another one? Do you want another one, you deaf bastard? Presumably the bartenders will be sliding the drinks down the bar to avoid getting too close to the punters. Or maybe they'll turn pubs into sushi bars, where you'll sit down and you'll rotate the table, right? You'll rotate it, turn it clockwise. Turn it clockwise. I want that Guinness there, over there. And I want that double Bacardi and Coke as well. Turn it clockwise. There'll be murders. What did you call me? Outside now. Mad stuff, you know. And this isn't being written as satire by UK journalists. You know, when you see it, you think, oh, that's funny. It's what they're actually proposing. Going to start channeling my status quo now. What you're proposing. Imagine, 3 points. 3 points, 3 points only. Sitting apart from people inside the pub. Marvellous. German doctors are posing in the nude in their surgeries to protest online over the lack of personal protective equipment, PPE. Germans, doctors are posing in the nude. They're not good looking. They're not. Don't go running to look. Don't go running to look. There are no blonde, buxom, blue-eyed Fraulines. It's always the ugly ones who strip off first, isn't it? Ever been to a nudist beach? You have. Ever been to a nudist beach? Put you off sex for life, really. Leathery skin, dangly bits scraping the sand. And they don't give a shit, do they, people on... I've encountered a couple of people on nudist beaches in the past. I accidentally wandered onto nudist beaches. Once in Spain and twice in Spain. Yeah, I think in Spain. And they don't give a shit, these people. Couldn't care less. So don't go running to look at the German doctors. None of them are good looking. Box Fizz has been blocked by Piers Morgan on YouTube, on Twitter. Did you see that? Cheryl Baker, for challenging his style. He's an insufferable arsehole, isn't he, Piers Morgan, eh? Morgan thinks he's an original. You know, it's been done to death, that style of asking somebody a question and then jumping all over them and criticising them before they've even finished one sentence. Worst presenter on television. Cheryl Baker said he wasn't that good and he blocked her. Thin-skinned, to say the least, I would say. What an ego. But then again, he might have been starting a new game, I don't know. Just blocking random, cheesy 1980s artists for fun, for the hell of it, I don't know. I don't know, he could be doing that. What else have I got for you? 16 minutes past five. Watching the clock, lots to get through today. Love a bit of Kay Burley. Top story this morning. Again, we talk about the insanity of the Twilight Zone situation we're in now, where the utterly absurd is presented as normal. Utterly absurd. Presented as normal. Here's Kay Burley this morning, introducing the programme at 8 o'clock. This is top story now. Top story. Top story this morning. Some random woman tells the Prime Minister to keep the lockdown going, really.
Hello everyone, a very good morning to you. I hope that you are all keeping well. 8 o'clock, you're watching Kay Burley at breakfast. This morning, we hear the plea of one young woman who lost her fiancé to COVID-19. Her message, don't lift the lockdown while Britons are still dying, Prime Minister.
Don't lift the lockdown while Britons are still dying, Prime Minister, says some random woman. And that's your top story this morning.
What kind of fuckery is this?
I've always said, you know, and maybe I've said it, maybe I didn't mean it, maybe I said it, maybe I wouldn't do it. If you can't beat them, the best thing to do is to join them. Join them. If you can't beat them, join them, right? Join them. Yes.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
It's just after 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show. First up this hour, Kitty from across the road tells the PM, open the hairdressers as her fucking curlers have melted onto her head. That's it. It's vaudeville. That's it. That's the standard. That's the media. Random woman whose boyfriend died says, don't lift the lockdown, was the top story on Sky News between 8 o'clock and 1 o'clock this afternoon. Do you want to hear a bit more of it? It's a matter of interest. Here is the story, as told by Sky.
Richard McCaig spent the last month of his life volunteering as a carer in his community until the symptoms started.
He said that he wasn't feeling well. He started with a bit of a dry cough. And I was like, oh, we was joking about it. Like, oh, you're going to get ill. He just deteriorated really, really rapidly. So He couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep, he couldn't walk, he couldn't breathe. And I called 111 for a bit of advice and they sent out the paramedics.
Richard was taken to hospital, but his condition worsened.
The nurse, the sister, called me and she explained that his body was tired. He was exhausted. He couldn't take in the oxygen that he needed, so they've made the decision to put him on a ventilator. So he did message me and he said, you know, babe, they're going to put me on a ventilator. He's like, I love you. I love my gran. Please tell my gran that I love her. And then
I wonder, did the ventilator have anything to do with his untimely demise? 29-year-old man. Now, I don't have any idea that it did, okay? I'm not being reckless here now. I have no idea, but we're hearing stories coming out of the United States, aren't we? You know, we had the Dr. Seidel from the emergency room in New York who quit his job. We heard the nurse from another hospital in New York City coming out saying that she believes the ventilators are actually doing for people, killing people. So I don't know. This is a young man who went in, fairly minor symptoms, was kept in hospital, and his fiance is on Sky News this morning. I'm laughing at Sky leading with the story that she's telling us all to stay indoors because it is ridiculous. But at the same time, I'm wondering, you know, surely he... I don't know. It's a question worth asking anyway.
And then he said, thank you for the best life.
Ricky wrote, it's a 50-50 chance. Those aren't great odds. Signing off, once I'm asleep, it's in God's hands. A nurse then held up a phone so that Ricky could video call Katie. It was the last time she saw him alive. The next day, while driving, she received a call from the consultant at the hospital.
It's hard. The call was less than 2 minutes long. You know, it was a matter of, I'm really sorry to ring you. As we were turning Richard back onto his stomach, he suffered a cardiac arrest.
Sorry to ring you. As we were turning your fiancé back onto his stomach, he suffered a cardiac arrest.
And we wasn't able to resuscitate him.
Mm.
So, I'm sorry, but he's passed away. And I'm driving, I'm on my own, I'm upset. And I was just kind of like, oh, okay, thanks for ringing. Because I didn't know how to react. I think I'm still waiting for him to come home. That's the hardest part.
At
29, Ricky is one of the youngest victims of this crisis.
Like
his family say that it is too early and too risky to begin to think about lifting the lockdown.
All me and his family want to do is stress the people. Stay home. You know, Boris has been telling you on the TV for weeks.
Well, if Boris has been telling us, eh?
For weeks. Celebrities are telling you. The news are telling
Celebrities and the news are telling us.
They're telling you. It's everywhere. But people are getting complacent now because it's been so long. You know, I'm seeing reports, oh, we want to loosen the lockdown. And Boris is saying, no, it's not a good idea. Mm. And I agree with him. If they just followed what they're asking them to do, I don't think we'd be in this situation.
That's what the media does, you know. Is use people like that. They've used that woman. I think she's been on BBC Radio 5 Breakfast this morning as well. And they take advantage of people like that. The ventilator thing interests me, and I don't think we'll come back to it today, but I definitely know we will come back to it tomorrow. Andy Kaufman, the doctor, is on the radio show with me tomorrow evening. We'll get to that then. In the meantime, there was a sad ending to that report, and it kind of evoked John Waters, the Irish journalist, who was back in court today in Dublin with Gemma O'Doherty, as far as I understand. This report with this woman whose boyfriend, whose fiancé died, it ended with this.
Like so many others, Richard couldn't have his family beside him in the end.
Why?
A cruel hallmark of this disease.
But that's outrageous.
Nick Martin, Sky News.
It's outrageous to me. It's outrageous to me that family can't be facilitated when somebody's in a very bad way and they might be... You know, they might be coming near the end. Although in this case, they said that they were turning the guy on his stomach and then he had a cardiac arrest, and I don't know. It smells a bit to me. But anyway, what do I know? Good afternoon, good evening, welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show. 23 minutes, it is past 5 o'clock. It is madness what's going on. What have we got for you? The Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, wants face masks now to be used by people going out in public in Scotland. You can hear a little bit of what she had to say during her briefing, her daily briefing today. Nicola Sturgeon.
The guidance also makes clear that the evidence on the use of face coverings is still limited. However, it recognises that there may be some benefit in wearing a face covering if you leave the house and enter an enclosed space where you will come into contact with multiple people and safe social distancing is difficult. For example, on public transport or in shops. Of course, just now, most shops are closed. So right now, this would apply in particular to food shops.
Nicola Sturgeon. And finally, for now, I want to thank Spiro from Activist Post for sending me this. You'll have heard the name Deborah Birx. She's the White House COVID response coordinator, coronavirus response coordinator. She's been on CNN overnight and she's been updating, presumably, CNN on the US government's response to the crisis. And in her conversation with CNN, she drops the mother of all Freudian slips, it is fair to say, Deborah Birx.
Do we have enough infrastructure to contact trace the way that we need to?
I think that's why the criteria that you can see the gates that are that the federal government has recommended are...
Do we have enough infrastructure to contact trace the way that we need to?
She mentions Bill Gates.
I think that's why the criteria that you can see the gates that are...
The criteria that Gates set are...
That the federal government...
Or the federal government. Which is it, love? Is it Bill Gates of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? Or is it your own government setting the criteria? It'd be nice to know that. What are the odds? What do you think are the odds that the CNN presenter jumped in to say... What was that about Gates? Of course he didn't say anything.
Do we have enough infrastructure to contact trace the way that we need to?
I think that's why the criteria that you can see the gates that are that the federal government has recommended are...
Yeah, straight from the horse's mouth. Yes, there's no need to say anything else there, is there? No, except it's 25 minutes past five. Don't forget, Tony Heller of RealClimateScience.com will be on the programme in hour two. Apparently he's moving home, Tony, tomorrow, and he said he'd fit me in anyway. Before that, though, Dr. Stuart Wayton will be on with me in a few minutes' time. We're going to talk about, well, some of the more worrying aspects of the enforced lockdown. The loss of civil liberties, and whether we'll get them back. Yes, because that's important, whether we'll get them back. Thanks for all your tweets, I appreciate them. I'm satisfied that we're streaming strong and loud on multiple platforms. My website, triggerwarning.tv, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, TuneIn Radio and lots of other platforms as well. A lot of people take the Richie Allen radio show. A lot I don't even know of. That's the absolute truth, by the way. Right, let's have some music. And while I do that, we'll get Stuart Wayton on the phone. Any comments, anything? What have I done there? Oh, Jesus. There you are. That's better.
We're going to dance and have some
fun. We're going to have some fun today. This is your Richie Allen radio show. Nice to be with you, as always. This is D-Light and Groove is in the heart. It is 5:30, D-Light, Groove is in the heart. The Richie Allen radio show live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Right, this is really important. So you've got the former UK Prime Minister, Tony Blair, saying that trading some of your freedoms or your freedom in the fight against the coronavirus is a good thing. We have to accept giving up some civil liberties. And he's not alone in saying that. It seems that the UK media is speaking with one voice. There's only one or two dissenting voices. In terms of the broadsheets and the best-selling newspapers, one or two dissenting voices, Peter Hitchens maybe. Is it worth trading away some of your freedom or your civil liberties to defeat a virus, is it? Let's ask our first guest that. I've an enormous amount of time for him. He's a lecturer, an author, a public speaker. For a short time, he was a politician as well. And he's a lone voice these days, challenging the introduction of thought crimes and hate speech, and how this is becoming more and more, I don't know, apparent in our everyday language, in the things we're discussing. He's doing a terrific job. He's a lecturer at Abertay University in Dundee. As I said, he's an author and a man who's written for several newspapers in this country. Criminologist, let's welcome back to the programme Dr. Stuart Waiton. Stuart, thanks so much for coming on. How are you?
I'm not bad, you know. Frustrated, as a lot of people are, I imagine. Frustrated in terms of my life, but also frustrated in terms of trying to get a handle on what's actually happening and what is the correct approach on this issue, which I think is it's very difficult.
It is difficult, but I'm going to go straight to the Blair quote. Well, partly quoting him or probably missed, but the gist of it was, and it's not just Blair, the gist is that to defeat the virus, if you have to be a little bit uncomfortable and accept that you can't do certain things, it's not a bad thing. It'll all be okay in the end. What do you think?
Well, as I say, it's difficult because I'm still not sure whether the understanding of the virus is right or not. And I don't think they know if their understanding of the virus is right or not. So it makes it kind of frustrating. So my instinct is to think that there's an exaggeration of a problem. And that's based on past experience looking at how past diseases have been understood and engaged with. So this is it. It's Neil Ferguson, I think it is. Is it the government's guy? If you look at his record, on things like swine flu and these other past kind of health concerns, he's been massively wrong and talked about 500,000 deaths and so on. And you've ended up with hundreds rather than his predictions. So that's difficult because we don't really understand this virus, and nobody fully understands how it's operating. And that's frustrating. But I think even if they're right, even if they're right about the way the virus is operating and that we need to socially distance and so on, if we just accept that they're right, which I'm not sure that they are, if we accept they're right, I still think there's a better way to do this, which, and I think in all of these things, it's a constant frustration that I have, that politicians don't seem to sort of constantly be aware of the fact that they're our representatives. They're not a power above us. They are a power because of us. And I think if we're going to do what we've done, it should have been much more through a public engagement where the public are involved in the discussion and involved in decision-making about things. So, for example, one of the things which straightforwardly I think is a problem is that there's a certain... there's an element to which the way we are restricted in what we can do is a little bit like we're being treated a little bit like children rather than adults. So, say, sunbathing in a park where you're not near anybody. It does nobody any harm. Playing golf in a field does nobody any harm. Lots of things. Driving to your second home does nobody any harm. Going to using your second home. There's lots and lots of aspects of life. And there was almost, especially early on, and I'm not sure where we are with it at the minute, there was almost a kind of puritanical zeal to condemn anybody who seemed to be having fun, who seemed to be using their spare time in a kind of joyful way, even though they were doing no harm to anybody else. So I'm very concerned about that dimension of it. and concerned the extent to which people are being encouraged to have a kind of almost mindless conformism. You know, thou shalt spend 1 hour only exercising, only within the vicinity of your estate, and so on. So there's lots of those sort of things I've been concerned about. I'm also concerned about the extent we only seem to be able to discuss getting out and being free if we attach the idea that it creates mental health problems, right? Which, you know, I know there's an element of that. But what about just celebrating freedom because it's important? You know, it's a fundamentally important aspect of modern life and being a modern individual is to be free. And I don't think we need to tag on it might create mental health problems. It doesn't need a tag on. It's a thing in itself that needs to be celebrated. And I think that, to a certain extent, the government's got that wrong in terms of how it's been a little bit patronizing to the public and not trusted them to, once you understand the social distancing rules, to then be able to be as free as possible while maintaining that discipline.
On that, is it a concern of yours that other opinions are being suppressed? I know I mentioned in my email to you today, Peter Hitchens has been trying to get people to listen to Carl Hennigan. I think they pronounce it Hennigan. In Ireland, we pronounce it Heenahan, of course. Carl is the top man in evidence-based medicine at the University of Oxford. So he's earned his stripes.
Yeah.
He's earned the right to an opinion. And he's been saying that Imperial College in Oxford has basically based what they suggested and did on computer modelling, not on real-life data. But what Carl Hennigan has done at Oxford is looked at the real actual data, not computer modelling. And he says the lockdown was absolutely futile, really. There was no need for it. And we know this thing peaked weeks ago and we should be ending the lockdown now. But apart from a fleeting visit to Newsnight with Emily Maitlis, nobody wants to touch Carl Hennigan. And you know, I think you and I have touched on this before. As a journalist, and I take great pride in calling myself a journalist, because I am, that really worries me, Stuart.
Yeah. Well, there's a few guys. I mean, the problem with this, and I suspect we're similar in what happens here, is as soon as this all happened, I went digging for experts. As did, like, you know, lots of friends of mine on Facebook who are like-minded. They find alternative experts who say what you're saying, right? So I've seen a German guy.
Yeah.
You know, there's an hour-long video where he describes, and this guy's a genuine, real professor, expert in his field. He makes the same point. There's a Swedish guy, a video of him, sort of old guy, just sort of like his World Health Organization attachments, all sorts of things. And they make this argument that, in fact, you know, lots of people probably already had it, but it doesn't really impact on most people. If, you know, as soon as you open the gates and people go back out, it'll just spread again. And in fact, the people who are going to die will die anyway. It's essentially people who are pretty vulnerable, pretty old in the main. And in fact, the lockdown in that respect is not only pointless, but is counterproductive in terms of the massive impact it's going to have on the world economy and on life in general, as we see. But I feel frustrated as well. I mean, I would like, why don't people get these different experts together? And, we have a public discussion about this. You know, we have a proper debate and they are brought together and, they have to sort of like contest their ideas and they get the scientific community to explore this, because it's frustrating, because I'm like you, I've come across these various individuals, and this Sweden are doing things very differently, but it might be because Swedish society is different. Might be Swedish society, 50% of Swedish people live by themselves, so they're more dispersed, less people in London are more likely to catch it because it's like big city life and so on. There's loads and loads and loads of factors. And I think you do get them, right? So I think these people, you can find these people, and there are the occasional newspaper articles here and there. What I find very frustrating is the television news, and I say this, I've virtually stopped watching television news because I just find it appalling. And I find the sort of when the government comes out and says its stuff, and the media just seem to be sort of like throw dirt at the government, and it doesn't seem to get anywhere as far as I can see. So that's what I found very frustrating, actually, is the mainstream news, because it's not just the mainstream news. It's like talk sport, right? So I listen to Radio 4 and talk sport, right? That's my radio.
Right.
And talk sport have their own jingle, you know, where it's like stay at home, save lives, right? TFM, so that's the big sort of independent news. So my girlfriend, she listens to TFM, so she always puts that on in the kitchen. I come in, turn it over on the talk sport, vice versa. So, and they have a jingle, right? Stay at home, save lives, blah, blah, blah. So for the kind of, at that level, it's just become this kind of mantra, you know, protect the NHS, save lives. And it just seems to be a kind of a nightly ghoul fest on the news where they just have this kind of deathometer. And I had a friend showed me, you know, number of deaths over the last sort of 10 years, and showed that actually 5 years ago there was more in the month of March than there has been in this month of March. And he thinks it's largely to do with a kind of a bad flu virus at the time. So there's all sorts of things that are going on that need to be discussed, but we have a very one-dimensional representation on the news. And I find it very frustrating that they seem to find every young person that has caught it or has died from it to try and represent this idea that everyone's at risk of it, whereas yes, statistically, everyone is not at risk of it. You're hugely more at risk of it if you're very old and ill already, right? And in general, if you're not very old and ill already, you're not going to die from this virus. Young people in particular are not going to die from this virus. But then you've got the NHS people, and they try and find every NHS person to say, look, you know, everyone can die of this, and the NHS workers are even more prone to die from it. And then the French sent me statistics to show that actually, statistically, NHS workers have died less as a proportion
That's
of the population than the population in general.
Yeah.
So that I think that television news and this kind of adoption of this moral position of, you know, we must save lives, protect the NHS, is very, very unhelpful and very unintelligent.
What I've noticed, that's a really excellent point. Stuart Waiton is our guest, by the way, folks. You can find Stuart on Twitter. I'll put links out there. Stuart is an author, a criminologist, lecturer, and a journalist. He's written some fantastic articles on issues around free speech and our attitude to free speech in recent years. Check them out. They're really worthwhile. I've been looking at something. I'm not a man of academia like you, and I don't have your skills, your research skills. I do in a different way, I suppose, as a radio producer, but not that sort of in-depth. One of the things that I've been looking at for years, for 3 or 4 years, having worked at every level of the media myself, increasingly, Stuart, I don't know what you think about this, I see the media these days, whenever anything happens, whether it's a terrorist attack, which is a terrible thing, whether there's a weather disaster, and now with coronavirus, the media seems kind of hell-bent on creating a sense of occasion and drama. And it seems to be trying to draw people into it and to condition people maybe to think that they're a part of it. And I see that in this clap for your NHS carers at Thursday at 8 o'clock. I see that. And it scares me that, because coming up in the media, your job was to report on stories that were in the public interest without prejudice and try and get, you know, every angle of it possible and present that to the audience. Now, I almost see a television production going on where people are being drawn into it in a way that maybe this is new. Maybe we need an anthropologist. I mean, you're half an anthropologist yourself, to try and explain what's happening and the impact it's having on people. And I think it's having a very negative impact in terms of whatever little bit of ability people had to question things. I think it's being eroded. I think the media is playing a huge part in this. What do you think?
Yeah. On the terrorism thing, I think there's a slight difference, though. What's interesting about the terror attacks is, I think, because of the tendency towards political correctness, what's very, very noticeable about terror attacks is they often try and play them down rather than play them up. They're happy to have people mourning and being sad, but they don't want people to get angry because they're kind of worried that the public are going to sort of light their little torches and go off and attack mosques and so on. So actually, I've found it very interesting that, like the Manchester bombing, which I think is probably the most disgusting thing I've seen happen on the British mainland in my lifetime, when all those kids were killed at the concert. It was almost kind of dampened down, you know, there's a nervousness in the media. They don't really want to talk about it, or at least not want to talk about it in a kind of strong critical way about, you know, sort of Islamic extremism and so on. So that's slightly different. But yeah, I think, well, what happened, in fact, I had a rant yesterday to my lass while I was watching the, because Martin Bell, you'll know Martin Bell. So Martin Bell's an ex-journalist who can be seen in his white suit because he tried to become a politician. I think he's a kind of UN something or other now, and he's on adverts to kind of help starving children in Africa and so on. But Martin Bell was kind of an interesting kickoff with this because he abandoned journalism as you describe it, and created what was called journalism of attachment. So instead of being kind of trying to be neutral and try and analyze and get the bottom of things, it was an argument that actually you need to take a moral stand, right? That there are simple, easy black and whitey, and then we'll take a moral stand. And so, you know, we know that the Serbians are evil and the Croats are all right. So, you know, I'm going to just go out and sort of like tell the world the Serbs are evil, even though it's a very complex civil war in Yugoslavia at the time. This is in the mid-90s. So that's where it kicked off. And that kind of helped undermine, I think, what journalism should be, which, as you say, should be investigative, neutral, presenting the facts as best as you can, rather than taking a certain moral or moralistic position. So, which is why he wears a white suit. I mean, you should never trust anyone in a white suit, because you know that they just think that they're Mother Teresa. There's some kind of holy moral being who somehow knows the truth and needs to tell us it. So yes, he should be a politician and abandon journalism, because that's not journalism.
No, he's a British UNICEF ambassador. You're right these days, Martin Bell. Yeah. Stuart Waiton is our guest. Another thing that concerns people, it's interesting, there's Hope Not Hate has put out a new document about conspiracy theorists. And another thing that's concerning to me is how quick people are condemned for asking questions about the influence wielded on our governments by Bill Gates and people like Gates. And I was presented with a compelling bit of information recently that showed that the UK Vaccine Network, which is 37 or so doctors and academics who have been convened to deal with the virus, 35 of them have taken money from the Gates Foundation to the tune of £200 million. It's a fact. And many of them have worked for some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. And these are companies who stand to make an extraordinary amount of money in the near future if a vaccine comes out and most of us are compelled one way or another to take it, which has been mooted, this idea that we should take it, otherwise the lockdown won't be ended completely. And again, the media is failing miserably on its watch to be at least asking questions about that. In fact, Trump's advisor dropped his name by accident on CNN last night, dropped Gates' name. This woman called Deborah Birx, you know, said, what Gates has decided to do. And he said, oh, no, I mean what the government has decided to do. So, you know, it's maddening to me. And then people who ask these questions that are written off, you know, as conspiracy theories. In fact, what Hope Not Hate is recommending today is that people spreading conspiracy theories about the virus or about 5G, they're actually causing harm or physical harm, and that they should now be deleted from the internet. It's not good enough to close down their YouTube anymore. It's not good enough to kick them off Facebook. They must be banned from having a website or being even hosted on a website. Now, I know you don't want to go down these roads. I have a different take on some of these issues than you do. That's the whole point of having you on. You don't agree with me in a lot of things. That's absolutely bloody fine. And we probably have a different opinion on vaccines. I'm sure we do. But there's no way you're happy with the notion that people should just be deleted from the internet, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. And I do disagree with you. I don't think there's a conspiracy. I always think it's a kind of... I think it's an easy way to find an answer, I think, as well, just looking for money, because it's a kind of it's sometimes a cheap trick that sort of people that don't like me will say, oh, well, look, people who you like, they're funded by such and such. but I say, they did get some money from this like capitalist guy, but do you think that's why they say? Do you think I say what I say?
Yeah.
Because of some capitalist guy, or do you think I say what I say because I actually think it's true, right? So if you don't like my ideas, challenge my ideas, right? That's how you should do it. And that, from either side, if you don't like someone's ideas or you disagree with them, think they're wrong, you challenge their ideas. It's very simple. It's a very, very simple principle. Is you challenge people's ideas front up, and you can say you're a conspiracy theorist or whatever you like, and other people can say, well, here's my evidence.
Yeah, exactly. This
is what I think, and here's what I think, and you can challenge it and criticize it and so on. That's how a free, open society should operate. I'm completely against the idea that we should just ban ideas because, you know, some people think that they're crazy ideas. The 5G thing, I think, is a crazy idea. But I wouldn't ban anyone from saying it. They can say it, and people can say, actually, that's not true, and they can challenge the evidence. That's how society works.
You know what's interesting about... And I, if everybody was like you, I can't find a better way to say this. If everybody was like you, the media would be a much better landscape to navigate, if everybody had your attitude. I agree the idea that coronavirus was caused by 5G is silly. At least it is to me, anyway. But I've also seen a study done by 200 scientists, and they're all from Ivy League universities, all of them, published in 2017, and they said that the impact of the technology on people could be fairly devastating, and yet nobody wants to talk about that. And I sometimes think that really serious questions, things that we should maybe be talking about, and I think you probably would agree with this, they get buried because somebody says something that maybe most of us think it's patently ridiculous. But the notion that non-ionizing radiation is harmful to people, that's not ridiculous. We've known that for years, and yet the 5G thing goes ahead. But you're right to make that point. On the Gates thing, the final thing I would say is, his influence is very extraordinary. And whether you agree with this or not, I don't think you will, but you might agree with one aspect of it. They are looking at the social crediting Chinese model. And I know they are going to suggest in the future, in the very near future, that a way to deal with these viruses is to take these vaccines when they're available. And I tell you what, Stuart, you might think I've got a tinfoil hat on, but I haven't. I've seen the evidence. They are going to say to people, we won't compel you to have it. They won't say, Dr. Stuart Waiton, you've got to have it. They might say, Stuart, you ain't going to be lecturing in any classes next week, mate, unless you have it. And that's very concerning to me. I mean, that's a civil liberties issue we can talk about.
I think you have a point in terms of, I think, individuals like Bill Gates, and there's other individuals like that, and they stand on different kind of sides. So there's sort of billionaires who are kind of a bit more sort of libertarian-y types, and there's billionaires who are a bit more social justice types. I think they have far more influence than they should have. And I think that's partly a problem of a lack of politics in a meaningful sense, where you don't have the public being strongly active and engaged. And in that respect, they would be able to swamp these individuals. And I think governments do potentially connect with these individuals more than they should, and these sort of expert bodies and so on. I think potentially have too much influence. So I think there's a truth in that. I think on the vaccine thing, I mean, you could make an argument that actually there's nothing wrong with making money from producing a vaccine, because that's how the competitive market works. You know, you've got people competing to try and make something.
Yeah.
They want to do it for two reasons, because it's going to, you know, potentially be very useful for getting rid of this virus, and also you can make money out of it. You know, you can argue about the ethics of that and so on. That's how the market system works, and in many respects, that's how progress has developed to a certain extent. As I say, you can raise ethical questions.
Can I make a 10-second...
I suppose the question you're posing is whether this virus is actually needed. I mean, to be honest, I think it would be extremely peculiar to end up with a virus being taken by everyone if there wasn't profoundly strong scientific evidence that this was useful.
You know, to finish with that, because I have one final question to ask you about the police behaviour. Thanks for engaging me on this, by the way. I know you'll get hammered for it later on, for going on the conspiracy radio show. But these are opinions that I didn't, you know, form lightly. I'm a bit savvy. I am somebody who has never taken what anybody else has said to me at face value. I've gone looking for myself. The thing that really concerned me finally about Gates was on his BBC Sunday breakfast show a couple of weeks ago. It's dreadful journalism. You know, you might think this guy Richie Allen, he's a bit of an idiot. I am, but at least when I've got guests on, at least I challenge them, you know, and I bring people on who disagree with me. Gates said, you know, we could rush this vaccine into production and we could indemnify the companies. I mean, Jesus, Stuart, that's shocking, that. And the BBC guy just sat there and said nothing. And I know that they do want to create a paradigm in the future where people have to be vaccinated regularly. And I think there are more sinister reasons for that, but we won't get into that today. But to be able to go on TV and say that, you know, first of all, to clear himself to be a health expert, which he isn't, he's a computer geek. And number two, to then say, indemnify the companies. I mean, Jesus, the BBC is supposed to be standing there on our behalf to say, no, mate, you can't rush stuff into production that could do a lot of harm, particularly when Gates' vaccines have done extraordinary damage in India. Not to mention that the swine flu vaccine a few years ago did terrible damage to people. So these are just the points I'm bloody well making. But I know you disagree. Do you want a final word on that before I ask you about the...
I think, you know, I suspect you have a point in terms of a lack of critical questioning on some of these matters.
Yeah.
I think certainly somebody like Bill Gates has got such influence, who is an unelected individual, then I think we should be constantly questioning what he is doing and the power and influence that he has, particularly because he is not a democratic representative.
Absolutely right. Hey, listen, final question. Thanks for coming on. When you're back in the summer, please God, you will be back. We'll talk strictly free speech issues and other issues of criminology. I'd like to get into criminology, which is sometime on the programme, actually, because I love reading you on these subjects. I was watching Dermot Murnaghan on Sky a few weeks back, and a woman, an Irish woman, came on. I was very impressed by her. And when I was listening to her, I thought of you. She was talking, her name is Fionnuala Ní Éilean. She's a Galwegian, she's from Galway, Irish lawyer, now working for the United Nations. And I thought she was really candid. She was talking about free speech and freedom of movement and powers seized by the state. And you came to my mind when she was speaking. Stuart, she said, I'm paraphrasing her now, but I'm not going to do her an injustice. She said, I wish I had the clip, I don't. She said, I get a bit worried, she said, when we have a virus. And she said, you know, we should be tackling viruses. I have no problem with that. But I get worried, she said, when instantly out comes 100 pages of proposed new legislation. And it looks to me, she said, like it's been around for a while, like it's been sitting in a drawer somewhere, that somebody was only waiting for an opportunity to bring out and to kind of impose on the people. And I thought, fair play to her, and I thought of you. Does she have a point? This is very sinister, this response, and to have police officers dragging people out of supermarkets. In Fallowfield in Manchester, a gentleman was torn from a front door. He was giving his elderly mum some shopping. The policeman threatened to tase him. And there's a lot of that, and you can see a lot of it online. The Manchester police is now asking people to report 2-1-1, to report conspiracy theorists to them. And I'm thinking, this is not good. And I couldn't wait to get you on to ask this question. What do you think?
Yeah, again, I try and get a balance on this because I do think that the government have... I think there's a number of things. I think at one level, the government doesn't fully trust the public. And that's, to a certain extent, why they have adopted fairly simplistic measures in terms of what we are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do, which I think is a problem. On the other hand, I think they've tried to do a kind of clamp down with a cup of tea. So they haven't done what Italy. So I'm talking to my mate in Spain who lives in Madrid with his three kids in a flat. And they haven't been able to leave the flat for 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible. They've not leave the flat and the kids. And so one of them can go to the shop, the nearest shop. They can't go to the next shop if that shop hasn't got the stuff, the nearest shop. And so, you know, compared with some of these other countries, the sort of the lockdown has not been very lockish in that respect. So, you know, I'd want to get a balance on that. But at the same time, I think over the last 25 years, there's been a tendency amongst governments and policymakers to think that their job is to make us behave correctly. So instead of, you know, it's this classic shift from being a responsible individual to behaving responsibly. So being a responsible individual is a sort of John Stuart Mill idea that you are an individual who takes responsibility for yourself. You're a moral being. You may make the wrong choices, but when you do, you know that you're responsible because you're a responsible individual. And that has been replaced by this idea of behaving responsibly. So the government tells you how to behave, and then you do what the government tells you, which is a very, very different thing. The first one's based on kind of liberty and freedom and respect for the individual. The second one is like the opposite. So that is where we've moved more towards this idea of we should behave responsibly, where the government tells us what to do, you know, develops new laws for antisocial behaviour, whatever it is. So they prescribe things, you know, they tax sugar and booze and all sorts of other things to try and make sure we behave in the way that they think is the correct way. So that is the kind of trajectory we've been moving. As it happens, what adds a little bit of interest to this is Boris Johnson is less of that ilk than some other politicians. So you might think, well, perhaps he might hold back some of that. But when he became mayor of London, the very first thing he did was ban alcohol on the underground after 9 o'clock. So even someone like Boris Johnson, who proclaims himself or would see himself as a bit of a libertarian, couldn't resist, as soon as he became mayor of London, doing a little petty clampdown on people's behaviour. So I think we've constantly got to be watching for this, constantly criticizing the police for being over the top on any of these matters, and try as much as possible to encourage from now on, to encourage the government to allow people greater freedoms, because that's what we need. We need freedoms back as quickly as possible for our, you know, just for our existence as individuals, as much as for, you know, the economy and everything else.
Good to have you on again today, Stuart. I love listening to you. Stuart has written several books. If you get a chance, check him out. He's on Twitter. It's at Stuart Waiton. There's a Wikipedia page too. But Snob's Law, Criminalising Football Fans in an Age of Intolerance, is a terrific read from a few years back. Good to have you on, mate. Thanks for doing something which we just don't have anymore. Engaging with somebody with whom you see the world a bit differently. Yeah. Imagine, it used to be the done thing, but not so much anymore. Thanks for coming on again today, Stuart. Speak soon.
Cheers.
All the best for now. Stuart Waiton, Dr. Stuart Waiton, PhD, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Tuesday, April 28th. Top man, like, listen to Stuart. Yes. Dr. Andy Kaufman on the programme tomorrow. Rima Labo on Wednesday. I've got an interesting lady coming on from Haifa in Tel Aviv on Thursday as well. I had a lovely chat with her today. I think you'll enjoy hearing from her. Her name is Shoshi Hersku. She's written a book about awakening, an Israeli lady, and she's coming on as well. So I've got some interesting people coming on over the next couple of days or so. Keep your tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show. I hope the Virgin internet issues in the country have settled down. I think they have. It was an interesting thing yesterday. The internet went down, but then when it came back, no matter what I did, I couldn't get my stream to reconnect. There was a small problem at the streaming company's end. Some very good news. I've been talking to Hayden about that. Some very good news. It's interesting that the Richie Allen Radio Show gets a mention in this new report into conspiracy theories that says that, the UK population, 6% of people have heard of the Richie Allen Show, which I think is a load of bollocks. I really do. I'm not modest. You know I'm different. You know this radio show is different than anything else. It's not about the messenger. It's about the message. I'm not important. This isn't the Truth or Industrial Complex. I'm no martyr to the truth. I'm not important. You'll never, ever see me broadcasting about how I'm under attack by the system. Me, me, me. You'll never see that. I'm not important, but the platform is. 6% of people in the country have heard of the radio. I don't believe it. But an extraordinary thing has been happening in the last few weeks. And that is, last week, my streaming company cut me off. They stopped me dead. It was over the weekend. It was Friday and Saturday. Without warning. Which pissed me right off, because I have never failed to pay a bill in my entire adult life. Ever. They were paid. And when I went ballistic and said, why is the stream stopped? They said, because you're consistently going over the bandwidth that you are allocated. What does that mean in English? Well, it means I'm streamed. I'm hosted by a streaming company in California. And when you listen on TuneIn Radio or Trigger Warning or Fab Radio 2, you connect to that stream. And they allow me a certain amount of listeners and bandwidth every month. They said to me, you've been going over your allocated 5 terabyte limit for the last couple of months. 5 terabytes, I said. Of audio, I said. Yes, they said. And I said, well, I normally get about 60 to 70, 75,000 listeners a day. And they said, mate, that was a long time ago. Your radio show is now being heard during the 2 hours you were on air by 120 to 130,000 people all the time, Monday to Thursday. And a lot of people are coming on to the stream later on to catch one of the repeat showings of it. So you're going over and over and over. And I thought, that's not a bad thing, is it? That's not a bad thing at all. Not bragging about it. But it's interesting, this happened at the weekend, and now a poll comes out to say that 6 people surveyed, in the biggest survey ever done, about how the conspiracy, so-called conspiracy radio shows are doing, in terms of are they known, are they known of. And they said that 6%, around 4 million people in this country, would have heard of the Richie Allen Radio Show. Well, maybe. Maybe. Back with some more on your Richie Allen Show after this from Rihanna. Music by Rihanna on the Richie Allen Radio Show. It's 11 minutes past the hour. It is Tuesday's programme. The good weather has disappeared. Yes. And it's, well, it's gone a bit miserable here in the northwest of England in the great city of Salford. I'm really chuffed. That's a great English word, chuffed. I'm really happy that my next guest has agreed to come back on the programme, because you really liked him when he came on the show back in December of last year. He's a geology graduate who's had a very, very successful career in science and education and in engineering. And his website is terrific. It's called realclimatescience.com. And he uses his website to academically and simply, sometimes simply, explain how the notion that man-made CO2 is an existential threat to the planet. He dismisses that and debunks it on realclimatescience.com. I invited him back on the programme today because he's been talking on his Twitter account. He's got a huge Twitter following. He's been talking about the lockdown and the coronavirus response and the damage that it's doing to the economy and the damage it will do to our livelihoods. But I also wanted to ask him back because there are a number of environmentalists who are really happy with the lockdown, and they are saying that maybe we should keep some of the lockdown in order to help the planet heal in the future as we go along. Let's welcome back to the programme from realclimatescience.com, Tony Heller. Tony, thanks for coming back on the programme. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for inviting me, Richie.
You're a gent, because you said to me today, you're moving tomorrow, is that right?
Yeah, I'm moving from Colorado to Wyoming tomorrow.
Wow, so that's like moving house, that's got to be a huge undertaking.
It's annoying.
Have you hired a lot of men, Tony, or have you got to do the heavy lifting yourself? Who's going to be doing that?
Yeah, I got a couple of guys coming down tomorrow to, I don't really have that much stuff, but a couple of guys coming down tomorrow to move the heavy stuff. So, I'm in good hands. Thanks.
Good. Well, look, good luck with it. I did it last year, this time last year, and it's difficult. And but we had maybe not so much stuff, but it was a bit of a nightmare over a couple of days. Great. I love reading you. I give you a regular mention, by the way, because since meeting you last year, I keep in touch with your website. And I'm keen in a few minutes to talk about some of these proposals about the lockdown. But as a man of science, as a man with a brain who can do his own research, you're really worried about the economic impact of this lockdown, aren't you, Tony?
Yeah, when this all started 6 weeks ago over in the United States, I put out a video on YouTube saying how to create a worldwide depression. And I basically described everything that was being done and what the consequences were going to be. I was down in Arizona filming wildflowers in the middle of March. And I was visiting with a friend's daughter who was working as a waitress at a Scottsdale restaurant. And when the lockdown order came down, and she was immediately let go. And she said to me, "Why would they have let me go if this is only going to be for 2 weeks?" She says she didn't think the restaurant was going to open back up again. So I started thinking about it. Yeah, you know, we've got all these people being put out of work immediately. The owners of the businesses have completely lost any trust in the government. They don't feel like it's safe for them to do business anymore. And if they've got any money in the bank, they're just going to take it and run. They're not going to attempt to do business in this sort of environment. Plus the fact that now we've got this huge population of people, you know, a lot of whom are very scared. They're scared of other people. And how are they going to go back to a restaurant or a movie theater or a concert with this sort of level of fear of other people? So I realized right off that this was going to be an economic catastrophe.
What you just said there, before we come back to the economics, it's fairly profound, isn't it, that there will be a real change in human behavior. You see, I didn't consider that until an English independent journalist echoed you, I think, on Monday. Might have been Monday, might have been yesterday, might have been Sunday, said the same thing. He said, when things are opened up again, he said, I wouldn't be surprised if people don't go rushing back out. And Tony, that will be almost like a second death knell, a second death blow to the entertainment sector, won't it? And to the food and beverage sector. Devastating it'll be.
Yeah, how are you going to get a lot of these people back in a movie theater? Because they're going to be looking around. Because, you know, this virus isn't going away. You know, coronaviruses, there's lots of coronaviruses. They come back every winter. And as long as people, you know, have this belief that there's some possibility that they're going to get sick from it, a lot of people are just going to be paranoid and refuse to live normal lives. Like I live here in Boulder, Colorado, which is one of the healthiest cities in the country, pretty young population. Everybody's doing outdoor stuff. You know, the death rate among people in this group is so low, you know, in Colorado, it may even be zero. But all these people, they're completely scared. They're paranoid. You know, you'd be walking down the trail, which we're still allowed to do here in Colorado, thankfully, and they'll walk 20 feet off the trail to avoid other people. And these are people who are in incredibly low risk groups, yet they are paranoid. And it's like a form of hypochondria, and it's really hard to imagine what it's going to take to get them back to functioning like normal human beings again when this is over. And by the way, Richie, I had a plane ticket to come to fly into London on next Sunday.
Did you?
And I was hoping Boris was going to come through for me yesterday.
Yeah.
He didn't.
No, he didn't. And here's the question now. I'm so glad you're on the show today. Yeah. What do you think American businessmen and women who might have voted for Donald Trump in 2016 because they saw him as being, you know, a successful, sometimes not successful, but then successful again as a businessman, and they probably thought that he had their backs. And it must be the same with business people in the UK, the Conservative Party, the party of business. They would have thought the government has their backs. What damage do you think it might do to Trump's chances of getting re-elected this year? And here's a conspiracy theory, if the election even goes ahead. But I mean, I think it probably will. What do you think? What impact will it have on him, do you think?
Well, you know, the lockdowns weren't done by Trump. They were done by governors and mayors. And he resisted them up to a point, although eventually he sort of gave in. And so, yeah, that's a really difficult question. You know, he clearly, you know, what he should have been trying to do was alleviate fear. You know, I'm a big fan of what they did in Sweden, which was to try to isolate the elderly. They weren't particularly successful at that, but that was their plan, was to isolate the elderly, keep them safe, you know, keep the kids under 15 in school, keep restaurants open, keep bars open, and keep their economy, damage their economy as little as possible. And every indication right now is that they have been fairly successful at that, and that there's a good chance they will have herd immunity next time this comes around in the fall and won't have to deal with it again. So that was, you know, I think that what they've done there, and their epidemiologists in charge in Sweden were brilliant. I know that Britain started down that path and then panicked and jumped off of it. And they weren't implementing it as well as Sweden was anyway. But
Tony, did they panic? You make a brilliant point there. At the very outset, the British government's attitude was basically very similar to the Swedes. That's an excellent point you make there. And then they deviated and they went with some models that were done by Imperial College. So ever the skeptic, I'm wondering, were they being given some bad information, or is it a bit more sinister than that? Is there something else going on?
Well, obviously they were given incredibly bad information. You know, the predictions were for millions dead. And, you know, it looks like the death total is going to come in globally, is going to come in at lower than an average flu season. So it was, and we're seeing, you know, it's numbers coming out in New York City, where it looks like the actual death rate was about the same as flu, something like 0.2%. There was an incredible amount of, you know, for older people, you know, this is a very dangerous disease, and people with, you know, underlying health conditions, it's obviously a very dangerous disease. But overall, for the overall, you know, population as a whole, it's not that much different than flu. And for children, it's actually appears to have a lower death rate than the flu does. So, so there was a lot of panic that went on. And, of course, as soon as the numbers start coming in and television showing pictures of people dying alone in the hospital, and, you know, it's very, obviously very difficult for politicians to resist that sort of thing. And so there was a lot of panic. I think, you know, the British government panicked. I think the American government panicked it. But I've been very impressed with the Swedish government, how they haven't. They, you know, they've stuck with it. And, you know, the deaths are going down everywhere now fairly fast, which could easily have been predicted because that's what coronaviruses do towards the end of April. And I think Sweden is going to emerge from this in much better shape than just about every other country.
If we give the politicians, I'm going to go along with you now. Let's give Boris Johnson's government and let's give the White House a pass. Let's say that they were given very bad advice. Some of the people who have given this bad advice are very much in favour of certain agendas. Some of them are big climate change fear pushers. Some of them are determined that we'll see a near future where everybody is vaccinated all the time against things. There are agendas at play here, and I'm only kind of positing this. I'm not saying this is true or it isn't. I'm very open-minded. So do we need to look at the possibility that the people given the advice, the bad advice to the politicians, whom will give a pass, that those people's motivations are very sinister? That it wasn't that they got it wrong, that they're trying to change something. I mean, look at the things they're proposing, you know, that we don't properly exit lockdown until, you know, everybody in the world is vaccinated. They're proposing that we have applications on our phones that makes it very easy to trace us everywhere we go. I don't like these things, Tony, but I'm open-minded. I'm here to be proved wrong if I'm wrong. And I look at those people and think, well, maybe Trump is honest. He's an honest broker because he's not a scientist. He doesn't know any better. But maybe some of the scientists, maybe their motivations are nefarious. What do you think?
Well, you know, the bad information initially came out of the World Health Organization, yeah. which is part of the United Nations, which is also pushing the climate agenda and saying that we need to reduce world population by 80% or whatever. So there's certainly reason to be suspicious that coming out of the same organization, yeah. that, you know, the same goals are at work here. And you know, I see lots of environmentalists here in the States and elsewhere bragging about how clean the air is and how nice it is not having the planes in the skies and not having the traffic and saying how wonderful this is for the planet. So, yeah, there's certainly plenty of reason to be suspicious that the same people are behind both agendas, yeah.
And it's fair to ask those questions. We don't have to provide any answers. That's why I like having you on. You're a scientist. And I'm a journalist. I'm not a scientist, but I don't have any answers. But I think people should be asking those questions. And it's really important that we talk about the climate change aspect of it because Piers Corbyn, who's a mutual friend, I believe, we talked about Piers briefly, I think, last time you were on. Lovely guy, Piers. He was on with me last week and we never got around because we talked about coronavirus itself. We never got around to talking about these suggestions that are creeping in now. It was even BBC Breakfast Radio this morning. You know, again, you touched on it there, Tony. This idea that the planet is healing and the fact that there isn't as much CO2. We might be inadvertently buying ourselves more time before the apocalypse. I'm so glad you're on. Tony's website is realclimatescience.com. It's a really good website, folks. I recommend you check it out. And you can find Tony on Twitter. He is Tony_Heller. H-E-L-L-E-R, obviously, at Tony_Heller on Twitter. And when I spoke to Piers off air, he said that he's not at all surprised that the climate evangelicals are now saying that we need to keep some of these aspects of the lockdown in the future to help the planet. Tony, that's... I don't want to be trying to oversell this or to be sensationalist. That's terrifying stuff.
Yeah. Well... You know, I'm a pretty hardcore environmentalist myself.
Yeah.
And I've been advocating for the idea of people telecommuting for years. That's been one of my main things. And so I think if anything good comes out of this, it'll be that hopefully people who can telecommute will be able to in the future. You know, that'll reduce traffic on the roads and pollution and cut down the number of deaths in auto accidents. You know, so that would be a tremendous benefit for society, and I hope that that happens. But as far as restrictions on freedom, you know, airlines going out of business, inability of people to take vacations, inability of people to work, I mean, those sort of things are horrific. And, you know, the fact that people are talking about trying to keep that in place, you know, is an indication that there is a very sinister agenda at work here.
I'm glad you're saying this, Tony, because maybe last time you were on, we didn't get enough time to go into it. But when I talk about you as somebody who's done a great job of poking holes in the idea that man-made climate change is going to end as a planet, which you do a great job of, it's also important to point out that you are an environmentalist and you are somebody who campaigns hard on a cleaner environment and a cleaner world. It's the climate evangelicals who've kind of, they've mixed those two issues together, haven't they? And they shouldn't have done that because we are dirty and we can stop being dirty and we should try to, you know, find increasing ways that we can, you know, be cleaner without, you know, it impacting on people's freedom. So that's important to say that, isn't it?
Well, you know, and it's much worse than that because one of my big issues over the years has been that instead of focusing on real pollutants, like nitrous oxides and, you know, particulates, the climate wackos have been kept us focused on carbon dioxide, which is not a pollutant. So instead of spending money and effort cleaning up actual air pollution, they've been focused on carbon dioxide. And if you look around at the places which have been really hard hit by coronavirus, it's places like China, Northern Italy, New York City, places which all have extremely dirty air. And this was pointed out by one of the top German immunologists early on, is that what's caught the place, the reason why some places are hit very hard and other places aren't, looks like it has a lot to do with air pollution. You know, people who are suffering from chronic lung ailments from breathing dirty air are much more vulnerable. So these climate wackos have directed all of this, you know, billions and billions, who knows, trillions of dollars directed towards trying to reduce carbon dioxide, money that could have been spent on actually cleaning up the air, which actually would have saved lives during this coronavirus thing. So they are culpable in a lot of ways for, you know, what's gone on the last few months. So, yeah, I have absolutely no sympathy, you know, or respect for these people, obviously.
No, of course you don't. And it's funny you mentioned the air pollution, because very early on, the journalist John Rappaport, whom I have a lot of time for, he's a great writer, lovely guy, John. John was talking about the pretty difficult conditions in Wuhan. It's a place that doesn't have a great air quality. It often has problems with it. And the use of incinerators there, which can be terrible things and put all sorts of awful things into the atmosphere. And again, the media just have completely overlooked this, haven't they? They haven't talked about it.
Yeah, my sister lived in Wuhan in the 1980s. She was actually the first American to travel around China unescorted. But, you know, back at that stage after the Cultural Revolution, and she had absolutely nothing good to say about Wuhan. She's just described it as a horribly dirty place. She described it as a one horse town with 4 million people. Now they have 11 million. Yeah. So it's, that's air pollution. And Northern Italy, you know, Northern Italy is the China of Europe. That's what their textile industry is. The air is terribly polluted there. And people there have chronic lung injuries, just like they do in China. So it was no surprise that they, you know, had a lot of people getting sick there.
That the virus would have affected them worse than other. Lots of interest in this on Twitter that you're on, which is great. Ewan has sent me a tweet, and he says, Richie, point out that at Dr. Erickson's press conference, this is a press conference given by a California GP, and he's been criticised for it, but he's asking some important questions. He said the lockdown and social distancing will deplete people's floral bacteria and immune system. The result will be a massive increase in illness among the general population when lockdown ends. Very sinister. Now, Tony, you've been tweeting about this. You've tweeted that one of the effects of the lockdown, inertia, people sitting down, gorging on food that's not great for them, that's not really healthy, binging on Netflix, I think you said today. Again, the impact later on the economy is going to be huge.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I, as soon as this started, one of the things that I did, Richie, was to go out and get in contact with as many medical people around the United States as I could. I met with a medical researcher at a large hospital in Phoenix. I was down in Arizona at the time, as I mentioned, right away. He showed me statistics that there was nothing going on at the hospital unusual, and that nobody at the hospital expected that there was going to be in the future. And he's stayed in touch with me ever since then and showed how occupancy at the hospital has been declining steadily. They never had a surge. And that they're laying, you know, they're furloughing people, medical staff now, because the hospital's empty. A large, you know, not empty, but it's they're way below capacity. And then I went off to, I spent a couple of weeks living in the home of an ICU nurse in Nebraska. And so I was getting first-hand accounts day after day about what was going on there. Same story in Nebraska. Very low occupancy, furloughing staff. And I've heard the same thing from doctors from many other parts of the United States, that there never was a surge and very low occupancy. A heart surgeon in Ohio told me he doesn't have any patients, and he's afraid that he has patients who are at home dying because they're afraid to come into the hospital. So, there's going to be huge, you know, when people finally do start showing up at the hospital, there's all these illnesses, chronic, you know, cancer, heart disease, all kinds of other things. There's going to be a huge surge of them. And we're going to have a shortage of medical staff because hospitals are laying people off because they don't have any business. So all that the press shows is these pictures out at New York City where they've obviously been completely overloaded. But they don't talk about what's going on around in much of the rest of the country where where hospitals are in financial trouble from no business.
And I've had contact here from from a nurse and from a doctor. I can't verify the doctor's authenticity, but I can verify the nurse's. I'm a stone's throw from Salford Royal Hospital, which is a very big hospital, and they've not been struggling at all with an overflow of patients or anything. And I believe that the Royal Infirmary in Manchester hasn't been hammered either. And what we have, Tony, we have this bizarre thing. We refer to it here as vaudeville. We have this thing where nurses and doctors are making videos of themselves dancing in the aisles of the hospitals to try and get themselves on social media, to try and get a bit of attention. And what you've described there, there's something very sinister going on then. I mean, the media must know this, and yet the media chooses to overlook it and to keep bombarding us with horror stories about how the virus is killing people.
Right.
And so we are in some sort of Twilight Zone type story, aren't we? I mean, this is rotten, this.
Well, you know, what you just mentioned, I'm going to delve a little bit into something that might seem a little bit scary, but... do you remember the 2012 London Olympics opening ceremony?
I do.
It was a devoted to the National Health Service.
That's right.
It was basically about a pandemic was the theme. There was a pandemic. There was all these children lined up in beds in the hospital. There were dancing nurses. That was a big part of it. And there was a girl who looked almost exactly like Greta Thunberg, who was featured in it. And she was lifted up into this giant, like 100-foot-tall effigy of death. And I would suggest going back and watching that, because there was a lot of really, you know, in context of what we've been seeing recently, there was a lot of very strange imagery. And like, what? And I remember at the time thinking, what does any of this have to do with the Olympics? This is not an Olympic theme where people from the world come together and celebrate being happy and joyful. Why do they have a, you know, this girl in pigtails being lifted up to death and hundreds of children in the hospital in a viral epidemic?
Yeah, it's amazing. I was going to ask you about this because I know you've been talking about it, and I looked at the footage of this, and because I didn't remember it, I'm not even sure I watched the opening ceremony, but I looked at it, and my jaw was on the floor, Tony.
It was pretty stunning. It was like there was a message being seen, there was a story being told. You know, and the incredible similarity of that girl to Greta Thunberg, her appearance was just kind of wow.
Yeah, when you look back now, and you know, there's a great, great, great friend of mine, and maybe you encountered him. Rest in peace. Loved the man. Used to speak to him every other day. I'm talking about Jim Mars from Texas, one of the great writers in your country's history. Wrote. Alien Agenda, which is a very interesting book about UFO history, but he also wrote Crossfire, which is the book that Oliver Stone used to make his film JFK. Lovely man, Jim. And Jim used to talk about predictive programming. He was one of the first guys ever to talk about that, about how things we see on television and in films, how often they start to bleed into public life and into news stories. And I think what you're describing, if Jim was alive now, he might say, you know, Jim was very, he was a man of science too. He would never declare something to be true. He would just, like you're doing now, he would just ask the questions rather than make definitive statements. And Jim would say, yes, that is incredibly strange. 8 years on, you're seeing nurses and doctors dancing. And sometimes, Tony, you know, it can't be spontaneous because some of these routines are very well choreographed.
Yeah.
And yet we're told by the same news media praising these doctors that they are off their feet. They are so busy. I mean, pull the other one. You know?
I know for a fact, I was living in the home of an ICU nurse in the middle of this, right? I know for a fact that, obviously in New York City, they were extremely busy. And in Northern Italy, they were extremely busy. But I know that many hospitals around the United States, they've been running at low or record low capacity. And they're, like I said, they're furloughing staff. So, yeah, and that's the story that it's not being told. And that was a story that was being told in that, you know, video out of California, which you started the discussion with. Yeah.
Do you feel, Tony, I mean, I have to say this because it's true. You're a smart guy, you know, and you're educated. You've educated yourself. You've had, you're a young man. You've had a very interesting professional life. The website is brilliant. I love referencing you. A guy like you, did you think you'd be in these times where people have acquiesced the way they have to the lockdown, the way people are snitching on one another, people are scared to go out, they will be scared to go out in the future, the damage to the economy? That's why I mentioned the Twilight Zone earlier on. I didn't mention it, you know, as a kind of a throwaway comment. It must be feel so bizarre to you that we are here now in this situation. Or are you shrugging your shoulders and saying, you know, it is what it is, we'll have to deal with it? How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, I've been watching, you know, the climate thing for a long time. I've been blogging about it for like 12 years. And I've been seeing this sort of very systematic propagandizing and misinforming of the public about climate. You know, just about every single story you see about climate in the news is not true. And there's obviously a huge amount of money and a huge amount of power behind generating fear about climate. So I've seen that there's been, you know, a massive disinformation campaign going on to frighten the public for a long time. So I can't say that looking back on it, I'm surprised at what's happened over the last 6 weeks, although I've been incredibly impressed with how quickly they've pulled this off. You know, just over the last 6 or 8 weeks, how they've managed to completely frighten society, destroy people's confidence in each other, to destroy people's ability to do business, to keep people off airplanes. All the goals which they seem to be wanting to achieve with the climate agenda have been achieved incredibly fast. And, you know, if this was done intentionally, the people behind it are absolutely brilliant because it's worked unbelievably well.
I wonder,
so,
Tony.
So yeah. So moving forwards, yeah, it's really scary.
Yeah, because I wonder. You know, they're talking about, they're talking crazy things. They're saying that in the next few months, if the public houses get open. Now, you know, you're talking to an Irishman. I'm barely able to stand up, Tony, because I've not been able to go to a pub for 5 weeks. Right? It's killing me, right? That I'm a social guy anyway. My better half, she's French, so she's not that into the alcohol, not like I am. But she's a social woman too. We like to be out and about. They're saying that people will only be able to go into pubs, maybe 10 or 15 or 20 people at a time. You'll have to sit apart. And you can only have 3 pints, 3 large beers. And then, you know, people outside will wait and then they will come in. And I have this theory, and I never get anything right, I'm always wrong. I have this theory that they're going to start suggesting things later this year, like, so imagine Tony Heller lives across the street from me. They're going to say, right, on the second Sunday of the month, Tony's side of the street, if you want to take a drive to a national park, you can. But on Richie's side of the street, you can't. You can't do that. And I think they're going to do stuff like that. And I think they're going to segue that into climate change then. I really do think they're going to try it, Tony. What do you think?
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me a bit because, I mean, I mean obviously the roads in England the traffic's been horrible, you know, for many years there. And it's very difficult to get places. And, you know, if you're a very rich, you know, if you're a member of the elite, you probably don't like having...
Yeah.
You're trying to get places. You don't like having the roads blocked by all these peasants in front of you. And so, yeah, why wouldn't they do that?
I don't know. I can't think of how it won't happen. I really don't, because what they've said here about the lockdown is that it's not going to end anytime soon. Some measures might be lifted, but they're saying scary things, Tony. Like they're saying, you know, the new normal, they're saying.
Right, I've heard that term, yeah.
And, you know, again, I know you've talked about this over the years, and I've looked at, I know you've only been on the show twice. I've been looking at your videos. I'll put links, by the way, to where you can find Tony on YouTube. A very popular YouTube channel has Tony. He doesn't need any of my bloody help, but I'll put links up anyway on Facebook and on Twitter to where you can find him. And yeah, the new normal. Language is so important to these people, isn't it? Language.
Right. Yeah, well, they've done an incredible job scaring people, and you know, half the population is going to be afraid to go and do things anyway. And they obviously wanted to reduce traffic. They wanted to reduce pollution. And, you know, now that they've got that, I don't see them letting go of it. Yeah.
I want to say this before we part company today. Tony's website is realclimatescience.com. Look for Tony Heller on YouTube. You don't need me to point you there, but I will put the actual link on Twitter and on Facebook. Check him out. Before you go, first of all, the best of luck with the move. My listeners want to know, Boulder, Colorado is beautiful. Why the hell are you moving?
Well, for one thing, it's really expensive living here. And the other, Wyoming is much cheaper for me to live because they don't have a state income tax. And here I'm living in an apartment in Cheyenne, Wyoming. I've got a nice house for considerably less money than I'm spending on the apartment here. But another reason, though, is just that Colorado has been completely taken over by people with very different political views from myself. You know, people in Boulder are constantly obsessed with fear about one thing or another, you know, climate, coronavirus, you know, whatever. They're always sure that the world's coming to an end. And in Wyoming, you know, in Wyoming, people are very different. It's a conservative state, and people are much calmer and more rational. And, you know, they don't wear masks, and they smile at each other. Yeah, it's just a healthier environment. Plus, a lot of things I like to do. I do a lot of archery, and I also like to shoot rifles, which you can't do in Boulder. They don't have any facilities for those. And in Cheyenne, Wyoming, there's like 5 rifle ranges and 7 archery ranges. So
sounds idyllic. It sounds idyllic, Tony. Even just to hear the name. I'm a big fan of American country music. So to hear Wyoming mentioned. It just gives me images, you know.
Right. So that's the thing. So I'm living about 5 blocks away from where they have Frontier Days, which is the biggest, like one of the biggest country music festivals in the country. It might be the biggest one. Yeah. So yeah, that it's going to be awesome being there if they actually have any concerts, you know.
Well, this is it. This is bloody it with this madness. Well, hopefully calmer heads will prevail, or calmer or wiser men and women will get a grip of it. Good luck with the move tomorrow. All the best to you, Tony. Thanks for coming back on today. Short notice as well. It was really good of you to do that. Loved listening to you. RealClimateScience.com, Tony Heller. Thanks, Tony. Speak again in the near future, hopefully.
Yeah, thank you, Richie.
It was an honour. Cheers, mate. Thanks for that. Tony Heller. And you heard Tony there. He was hoping to be in the UK this weekend. I think he said that earlier on. And was hoping that Johnson might have had better news at his briefing the other day, but he hasn't. So, thanks to Tony Heller, realclimatescience.com. And it's at Tony_Heller on Twitter. That's where you'll find him on Twitter. Check him out. Give him a follow there. Yeah. That's where we're going, isn't it? Let's be clear about it, right? That's where we're going. Right, we're going to have to ration travelling. And I don't think at any time in my independent career, after I left the mainstream, I don't think I've ever, you know, ever spoken like this, you know. I've never emoted like this. But I believe it. It's Tony_Heller. That's the one. Oh, it's 2 underscores, is it? Ah, there you are. Yes, 2 underscores, Tony is telling me. I'll correct that. So if you're looking for Tony on Twitter, it's at Tony_Heller. There you are. Double underscore. Thanks, Tony, for that. Yeah, so that'll be the gist of it, I think. They're going to let children go back to school alternate days. They're talking about that. You see, where I live, Salford, there are a lot of community schools. There are a lot of primary schools in Salford, and there are some secondary schools. There's quite a few, actually, situated around Buell Hill Park in Salford. And I think one of the things they're planning is to say, on Monday and Wednesday, early on, these schools can come back. Those ones over there. Tuesday and Thursday, these schools over there. In the beginning, they're going to say this. they're gonna decree that it'll be best for everybody to help maintain social distancing. And I think that these evangelical climate change clowns, what did Tony call them? He didn't say climate morons, did he? He said something like that. Climate idiots, or he had another way of describing them. They're going to be screaming for this to be maintained in the future, to minimise our CO2 footprint. It'll be a good idea if we take turns in going for weekend drives in the countryside. Just as one thing, you know. And that's how I see it. 11 minutes to the top of the hour. Yes. Right. I'm going to take a tune. I know I'm not long away from the close of the programme. I'm going to take a tune anyway. So here's our Bruce the Boss Springsteen and a Thunder Road on your Richie Allen radio show. Back in a minute. Thunder Road from Bruce Springsteen on the Richie Allen Radio Show, Tuesday's programme. I'll be back with you in 60 seconds.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to the program. I did have a word with Mark last night. Mark Byerski was supposed to be on the program, but there were technical problems. Well, first of all, the Virgin Media had problems right across the country here. There was outages right across the UK. That was an issue. But there was also a streaming issue with my company anyway, which is remarkably coincidental. But it is a coincidence. No, nothing untoward going on there. Before I go, I just want to point out again, because I didn't make much of it. I made light of it earlier on. But the anti-racist organisation Hope Not Hate here in the UK. Now, if you didn't know any better, you would look at their website, you would look at their Twitter page or their Twitter account, and you might think that they're much of nothing. Nothing to get your knickers in a twist about, Richie. That's how it appears. But these people are shaping government policy around censorship and hate speech. Censorship as a result of this new paradigm that we've entered, this new room that we've entered. All of a sudden, we're inside a room, we walk through a door. We're in this world where people can lose their jobs. They can be deplatformed. They can maybe have their social media accounts deleted. I know losing your job probably, you know, far worse than having your Twitter account closed down. But you can basically be exiled. You can be exiled. Digitally exiled, basically. You know, they might have your PayPal account closed down. They might have your bank account closed down. Because it has been deemed that you are a hateful person who promotes hate. Greater Manchester Police, amazingly, are asking people to phone them, to tell them about people spreading hate. How do you spread hate? It's not like fucking peanut butter, is it? How do you do that? Hate. These are non-crimes, you see. Hating something isn't a crime. Makes you a bit of an idiot, really. If you hate gays or lesbians or trans people, if you hate them. If you hate Catholics or Protestants or Jews or Muslims, you're a bit of an idiot. But you can't legislate for that. But this is the paradigm we're in when this is becoming a real thing. And what Hope Not Hate has basically done in this study that they've published, which they say is exhaustive, where they polled people for months. Ordinary people. They've not been polling conspiracy theorists. Not that conspiracy theorists are not ordinary people. They are. We are. To try and get a grip on how conspiracy theorists and theories flourish. And one of the things they want to do is promote the idea that conspiracy theories are causing real harm to people. Tangible. That you can see it. That you can measure it. And because of that, they're saying that not only should they be demonetized, not only should they lose their YouTube channels or their Twitter account, but that they should be deleted from the internet. Never to be seen again. Online. And that then would discourage other people from, as they have said, the authors of the report, it would discourage other people from spreading conspiracy theories. It would teach everybody a lesson. Don't talk about 5G. Don't talk about viruses. Don't talk about vaccines. Don't talk about false flag terror attacks. Don't do any of that. Because if you do, you'll be deleted. There is a Ministry of Truth. Go to the Ministry of Truth for the official version of anything. And that's the line that everybody has to take. Outside of that, you're gone. I'm not saying that's here now. Of course not. But that's what they want. And these people shape government policy. Thanks so much to Stuart Waiton, PhD, for coming on the programme earlier on. And again, thanks to Tony Heller. It's at Tony_Heller on Twitter and realclimatescience.com. Really enjoyed listening to both of them. You and I will talk again tomorrow. Dr. Andy Kaufman will be among the guests on tomorrow night's programme. And, oh, why don't I have the diary with me? Listen, I'm packed out for the next few nights. Really appreciate that. Mark Bajerski will be on with me early next week. Mark is loved, and rightly so. And you missed him last night, so did I. He'll be on with me next week. Going out with Freddie and the Boys.